Okay. So thank you very much. Introductory remarks. It's a very nice joke, which I'll keep for future lectures, since it applies to me as well, obviously. Now, I would like to switch to German for a few moments. Ich möchte mich zunächst.
First of all, I'd like to thank the organizing committee for the invitation to my real home. I spent most of my life in Lindau, second to Göttingen, and I attended school in Lindau, and I heard with a lot of interest from the State Minister of Justice of Bavaria that a polytechnic is to be set up in Lindau. I would support that proposal, and when you know how things go, it will soon be upgraded into a university, and I hope that there will be room at this university for neurobiology then, in due course. My paper will be presented in English for one simple reason. At the last meeting, I presented a paper in German, and the other reason is that this morning, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung ran a commentary about the work I'm going to report on today, so that those who want to know about it in German can read it in German at the in the Frankfurter Allgemeine. So, I'll speak English. To my great pleasure, I saw that more and more foreign students come to Germany, and probably it's unavoidable that in a few years, at least in the natural sciences, all teaching events, at least half of them, will be presented in English. I'll make a beginning, and perhaps that might be taken up at the university to be founded at Lindau.
Relates to the question of whether one can find cellular equivalents of what you might call higher brain functions in the cerebral cortex. What is a higher brain functions? There are many higher brain functions. The most popular ones or most known ones are the ability to recognize an object, the ability to learn, or the ability to retrieve some facts from your memory. Now, such higher brain functions are tightly linked to the integrity of a structure of the brain, which is called the cerebral cortex. This is a part of the brain, which is about 5 millimeters in thickness and covers the whole brain like a sheath. And it has been known since the work of Broca, a French neurologist, that for such higher brain functions, and he discovered this at the ability to understand language, that this ability of higher brain function requires the intactness of the gray matter. So in order to perform higher brain function, gray matters. This initial discovery of Broca that the ability to understand and to vocalize, to verbalize, depends on a very small part of gray matter, was subsequently shown for many other higher brain functions. Mostly, this was achieved by analyzing the brains of patients that suffered from some sort of neurological or psychological or psychiatric disorder. And after these patients had deceased, one was examining their brains and found indeed rather localized changes in their brain structure, and this has led to the notion of a landscape of the soul, where basically each part of the brain was assigned a particular function. Now, after these initial attempts, this field of assigning higher brain functions to particular brain regions, in particular to the cortex, was rejuvenated or received a very big boost with the invention of what we call imaging techniques like PET scanning, functional MRI or optical imaging, which have allowed to look at changes in the metabolic activity in different parts of the brain when a normal subject performs a higher brain function. This is shown in the middle part of this slide, which I took from a publication of the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, where they did a fMRI scan of a subject that was looking at a change in color. So what's probably happening in your and in my brains when you look from this part of the slide to this part of the slide, there is an increased metabolic activity in the occipital lobe of our brains. Now, I think one of the major insights that one gained from this type of analysis was that also brain functions which require only a very short time, let's say hundreds of milliseconds or seconds, can be sharply localized to particular parts of the brain. The second insight that one gained was that for many higher brain functions like recognition of an object in your visual space, it's not one particularly well-described area, but it's usually multiple areas that are increased their metabolic activity. Now, one has to be aware in analyzing such pictures that what we see by the increase in metabolic activity encoded by the lighter color here, that this reflects the consequence of electrical activity. And in order to understand higher brain functions, like processes that underlie recognition of an object, one has to identify the electrical signals that cause this change in metabolic activity. Let me explain this a bit more exactly in the lower part of the slide. This is taken from the work of Tobias Bonhoeffer and Amiram Greenwald and Joachim Malach from the Weizmann Institute. And if you look at the scale bar, you see that with this method, optical imaging, one can define much finer structure of the brain. This is an increased, each color represents an increased metabolic activity when a person is, in this case it was a monkey, is watching a visual object moving through the visual space in different directions, and each color encodes a different direction, and you can see this very beautiful pinwheel structure, indicating that when an object moves through your visual space, different parts of the brain increase their metabolic activity depending on the direction. What I want to draw your attention to is that, again, this is a representation of a part of the brain in this area which increases its metabolic activity during the process of cognition of an object. What we want to know, however, is what are the electrical signals, what is the pattern of electrical signals that underlies this change in this cortical architecture. And that's the topic of my talk. I would like to focus on the question of whether we can identify at the cellular level, that is at the level of one or two or three neurons, processes which might be related to higher brain functions. In order to do so, I would like to briefly introduce, for those of you who are not neurobiologists, the anatomy of these cells. These are projections of the constituting elements of the gray matter, nerve cells, pyramidal cells. And I also would like to briefly describe the two types of signals by which the brain is run. The next slide shows, next slide please, a reconstruction of two of these pyramidal cells. In the previous slide, you were looking from this direction onto the surface of the brain. Now we are looking sideways into the brain. You can see the brain is structured into six layers, labeled from 1 to 3, 4, 5, and 6. And there is a particular class of cells which we refer to as pyramidal cells. They make up about 90% of all the cells in the central nervous system. And one particular class is the class which is shown here. These are pyramidal cells that have their cell bodies in layer 5. And there is circumstantial evidence that whatever is calculated or computed in the cortex is sent to the rest of the brain and to the rest of the body via the activity of these layer 5 pyramidal cells. So these layer 5 pyramidal cells are sort of the readout neurons of the cortex that tell the rest of the brain and the rest of the body what to do. Now, these pyramidal cells have three building parts, a dendrite, a dendrite, a dendritic arbor. This is the receiving part of a neuron. The soma, which contains the nucleus. This is the place where gene transcription takes place, where metabolic enzymes are made and degraded. They are sort of, the soma is sort of interesting for the upkeep of the normal structure of the neuron. And a third part, which is called as the axonal arbor. So there are three building blocks, dendritic part, the soma, and the axon. And the information flow is such that excitation from other cells is received over these dendrites. They converge at the soma, and then they are transmitted via the axon to other neurons. The two types of signals by which the brain or these cells are operating, the two types of signals which we know, is shown in the next slide. And this is a repetition of what Erwin Neher said, and I show this slide to pay tribute to Alan Hodgkin and Andrew Huxley, who discovered the action potential and rationalized what happens at the action potential. The action potential is that electrical signal that subserves the transmission of information within a neuron along the axon. It is a brief change in voltage lasting about a thousandth of a second and having an amplitude of about a tenth of a volt. The other type of signal by which the brain operates is the postsynaptic potentials discovered by Sir John Eccles and by Sir Bernard Katz. And as you have heard in the lecture of Erwin Neher, these potentials are generated by the release of a transmitter under the influence of calcium causing a postsynaptic potential, which has much smaller size in the order of about a hundredth of a volt and a much longer duration in the order of 10 to 100 milliseconds. Another important difference between these two types of signals is that the action potential is propagating along these axons, whereas the postsynaptic potential is generated locally and spreads only passively along these extensions of these neurons. Both types of signals are generated by the reversal opening of ion channels, as indicated by these red structures. Now, so what I would like to focus now is the question of whether in the brain or in these brain neurons we can detect mechanisms that would allow the brain to detect coincident input from different parts of the brain, let's say from two different modalities. Think in a rodent of a tactile stimulus and a visual stimulus. In the second part of the talk, I would like to show experiments where we found, or we think we have found, a mechanism whereby such repetitive activity, which is created by these coincidence detectors, the strength of the synapses between these layer 5 pyramidal cells is increased or decreased depending on the relative time of occurrence of EPSPs and postsynaptic potentials. The next slide shows the experimental preparation where all these experiments were done. We used what is called a brain slice preparation. This is a small slab of brain tissue cut from a particular region, in our case, from the cortical region of the somatosensory cortex. It has a thickness of about half a millimeter, and we're using patch pipettes in the whole cell recording mode explained to you by Erwin Neher in the previous talk in two ways of configurations. If we want to study, when we study the signaling within the neuron, that is asking the question, Are there mechanisms that allow these neurons to detect coincident input? We are recording with two or three independent pipettes from various parts of such a neuron, let's say from the dendritic, from the dendrite, from the stroma, and from the axon. So I'll use the experiments I'm going to talk about in the first lecture, will use this type of recording configuration. The experiments relating to the question of how the synaptic strength between these neurons based on coincident activity is changed will use this type of configuration, where we can record from two or three neurons independently and stimulate and record under artificially imposed action potential patterns, so that we can drive these circuits at will, just as we want it, in order to answer the question of how, whether, for example, coincident input changes synaptic strength. So these are the two recording configurations, signaling within a neuron and signaling between neurons. The next slide shows an example of such two neurons as you see it during the experiment. This, you can recognize two neurons with their somata. You can see the pyramidal shape. Each soma gives rise to an apical dendritic tree, part of which you see here or here. And it also gives rise to an axonal arbor, part of which you can see here. You have seen the full reconstruction of a pair of neurons in one of my previous slides. I just want to show you how this looks during an actual experiment. Now, if we want to know how a single neuron of this layer 5 pyramidal cells, the output cells of the neuron, handles coincident input, we have to be able to record from different parts of the neuron, let's say the axon, the soma, and the dendrite. This is shown in the next slide, which is a fluorescence micrograph, a fluorescence picture from such an experiment, where I included a fluorescent dye into the pipette that is recording from the soma, and another fluorescent dye that is recording from the dendrite. You can see from the mixture of these two colors around here that indeed we are recording from the same neuron. This is not done regularly. Usually we take electrical signals to indicate that we are recording from the same neuron by injecting current in either one of these pipettes. Now, when we did this experiment, we first asked where in this neuron is an action potential generated. The next slide shows the answer to this. When a neuron, a layer 5 pyramidal neuron, a reconstruction which you can see here, is recorded from with three different pipettes, a somatic pipette in blue, a axonal pipette in red, and a dendritic pipette in yellow, and it is stimulated by the synapses in layer 1, one can observe the following sequence of events. This is a recording of the membrane potential with these three pipettes. Following a threshold stimulus, an EPSP is first recorded with a dendritic pipette because the EPSP is spreading passively towards the soma. Then it is recorded with a somatic pipette and almost simultaneously with the axonal pipette in red. However, the action potential is first recorded with the axonal pipette, then with the somatic pipette, and then with the dendritic pipette. Now, the only interpretation of this result is that an EPSP, this is the synaptic potential, is largely passively spreading towards the site of action potential initiation, which must be in the soma, somewhere in the soma. It's not quite clear. We have not been able to delineate this with high precision, but it's more than 100 micrometer away from the soma. An action potential is initiated, and this action potential propagates along the axon. This is well known since many years, but to our surprise, we also find that the action potential backpropagates into the dendritic tree, as you can see from this yellow dendrite, from this yellow trace. So what's apparently happening? When an EPSP is generating an action potential at an action potential initiation site in the axon, the action potential spreads in two directions, in the forward direction and also in the backward direction. And we were wondering what could be the function of such a back propagation of action potentials. Remember that for many years it has been thought that dendrites are purely passive elements. This is probably true for the motor neuron and a few other neurons, but in these CNS neurons, it's a different story. Now, one glimpse of what this backpropagating action potential might be useful for the operation of the brain, became clear to us when we found that when we were able to record even further out, this is about a millimeter, further out in the dendritic tree. Next slide, please. If we record even further in the periphery, close to layer one, and inject a small amount of current or stimulate a synaptic current, we find that there is a second action potential initiation zone in the distal part of the dendrite. This is shown by these yellow traces. This is the recording pipette. That's the EPSP, which we generate by stimulating these synapses. There's a subthreshold response, but we found very, very soon that also a local action potential can be generated. Now, interestingly enough, this this action potential is not propagating down to the action potential initiation site. This is shown by these blue traces. All the soma sees when an action potential occurs in the upper part of the dendrite is a small depolarization, which has a very complicated shape. So to repeat, by using multiple simultaneous recordings from different parts of these layer 5 pyramidal neurons, we found that there is an action potential initiation zone which produces largely sodium-dependent action potentials, but there is another action potential initiation zone which is operated mostly by calcium, voltage-dependent calcium channels. You can see this from the width of this action potential. It's mostly a calcium-dependent action potential. So these layer 5 pyramidal neurons have two action potential initiation zones, and one wonders how they would cooperate to deal with input arriving from different layers. This is layer 5. You can see there is a basal dendritic tree, and this is layer 1. That's an apical dendritic tree. Both are very intensively innervated by efferents from these layers. Now, the next slide shows what is happening. Next slide. If we combine a single stimulus to the soma, simulating input into the basal dendrites, causing a backpropagating action potential, if we combine this with a subthreshold EPSP generated again by current injection into the dendritic part. So what you see here are records in yellow are recordings from the dendritic pipette. The records in blue are recordings from the somatic pipette. If we inject current or stimulate, we get a subthreshold EPSP, which is larger if it's recorded here than at the soma. If we inject current to generate an action potential, this action potential will backpropagate, very strongly attenuated. Now, if we combine these two stimuli, that is a subthreshold EPSP with a backpropagating action potential, we find that a new pattern of action potential is generated, and that's shown in the lower part of this slide. This is the result of an experiment where this type of stimulus was combined with this type of stimulus, that is, a subthreshold EPSP was combined with a backpropagating action potential, and you can see that instead of one action potential, all of a sudden three action potentials are generated. So by combining inputs to two different parts of the dendritic tree that are located in two parts of the cortex, two layers, we can generate a new pattern of activity which we refer to as burst pattern, and it is well known that in most recordings from in vivo recordings, this is a typical pattern of activity in cortical neurons. Now, this becomes interesting, this new phenomenon of a burst activated by two independent substrate by two stimuli to different layers, because it is very time sensitive. Next slide shows the time sensitivity. In this experiment, we did exactly the same as you saw in the previous slide. That is, we combine a EPSP with a backpropagating action potential, with the exception that we shift the EPSP and the backpropagating action potential by various amounts of time indicated in the upper part of the slide. And what you can see quite clearly, there's only for a interval between the EPSP and the backpropagating action potential where this new pattern of action potential is generated. If the interval is 3 milliseconds, nothing is happening, they simply summate. If the interval is 11 milliseconds, also nothing is happening. But for 7 milliseconds, there is a new pattern of action potential activity generated in the layer 5 neurons and sent to the rest of the brain. Now, the next slide shows a summary of many experiments. It's not always as sharp, this time window, for the backpropagating action potential on the EPSP. This is a summary from 20 such experiments, and you can see that on average, this time window for lowering the threshold to generate this burst activity is in the order of about 10 to 15 milliseconds. So if a backpropagating action potential is occurring coincident with a EPSP in the apical part of the dendritic tree, we generate a new type of burst pattern, and this new type of burst pattern is only generated if the interval is in the order of 10 to 15 milliseconds, suggesting that this could be one mechanism of how in the central nervous system, that is in the cortex, coincident input from different cortical layers is recognized. It's recognized by generation of a new pattern of action potentials. The next slide, the next slide shows that this coincidence detection mechanism based on backpropagating action potential and input to the distal dendrite is very sensitive to inhibition by a second class of neurons that are part of the cortex. These are inhibitory neurons. They release as a transmitter GABA and they hyperpolarize the cell. It's possible to record simultaneously, not only from the pyramidal cells, but also from inhibitory neurons. This is indicated in this slide. We are recording with two pipettes from the red pyramidal cell. At the same time, we are recording from an inhibitory neuron. We generate this new pattern, which we called backpropagated activated calcium spike firing by coincident input. And then we combine this with the activation of the inhibitory neuron. You can see that the inhibitory neuron has its synapses in the shaft part. The EPSP, the IPSP is much larger for this recording than for this recording. If we combine backfiring with inhibition, this generation of a new action potential pattern is completely blocked. So this detection mechanism for coincident input is under the control of local inhibitory neurons. The next slide rationalizes this in a somewhat more schematic form. What we have found for these layer 5 pyramidal neurons is that one function of them could be that they act as coincidence detectors. This coincidence detection is based on the presence of two action potential initiation zones, one in the axon, one in the dendrite. You have two inputs, an input to layer 1 and an input to layer 5, that are under the control of inhibitory neurons. Now, for those people who come from electronics, this is an old hat. That's simply an AND gate, a time-sensitive AND gate, which is an electronic component that's used very much in electronics. So if we rationalize the function, one function of these pyramidal neurons, it would be a time-sensitive AND gate that detects input into the apical and into the basal dendrite. Now, how can we relate this to the normal operation of the brain? The next slide shows a speculation how this might be used by the cortex. This is a schematic representation of two parts of the cortex, let's say the visual cortex and the somatosensory cortex. Both cortices have efferent inputs to the basal dendrites from the respective sensory organs, that is from the eye and from the vibrisse. And it is known that these visual cortices, or these cortices, are interconnected by collaterals, which end mostly in layer 1. So if you look at, let's say, a layer 5 pyramidal neurons in the somatosensory cortex, it has primary efferent input from the vibrisse, and it has an input from a secondary visual, from a secondary part, or from another part of the cortex, let's say the visual cortex, which is primarily in the apical dendrite. And if, or one way of how a rat could detect coincident visual, coincident visual and a tactile stimulus would be by combining input into the basal dendrites and into the apical part of, the, of these dendrites, where, as I showed you, combining a subthreshold EPSP with a single backpropagating action potential, which is generated because these inputs are much stronger, this would generate such a pattern of 3 or 4 or 5 action potentials. So this is a pure speculation, but it is amenable to experimental verification. And in the moment, we are just trying to find out whether in a normally operating brain in animals under anesthesia, we can detect phenomena which resemble those which we see in the slides. The second part, I would like to ask the question, having found a mechanism that is able to detect coincident input, let's say into two different sensory, from two different sensory areas, what could be a mechanism to enhance such a detection mechanism? It is well known from behavior, animal behavior, that if one combines, let's say, a visual input and a somatosensory input repeatedly, which causes some sort of a reaction, let's say an escape reaction, that with the number of presentation, the threshold for eliciting such a response falls dramatically. So apparently, if such coincident input occurs repeatedly, there is some sort of a change in the wiring of these neurons, which causes an earlier response, that is a response to lower stimuli. This would be the sort of short or long-term plasticity Anea was talking about. And in the second part of my talk, I would like to show experiments that relate to this question. The next slide shows the situation that we were investigating. I told you that an action potential generated somewhere in the axon propagates along the axon, releases transmitter, but it also backpropagates into the dendritic tree. Dendritic tree is a structure where most of the synapses are located, and therefore we expect some interaction between the EPSP and the backpropagating action potential. And this could be one candidate mechanism of changing the synaptic strength if there is an interaction between the EPSP and the backpropagating action potential. This was sort of our working hypothesis, and we tested this. Next slide, please. In this following recording configuration, this is a reconstruction of two of such layer 5 pyramidal neurons. You see two whole cell recording pipettes, one presynaptic pipette that is used to generate a presynaptic action potential and a postsynaptic pipette. These two neurons are interconnected by reciprocal synapses. The next slide shows this after some deconvolution. This is a black neuron, the red neuron. Superimposed, you see the green axon tree onto the dendritic tree of this receiving neuron. And in this case, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 synaptic contacts are made. And as you remember, we are stimulating this neuron and we are recording the EPSP from this neuron using patterns that we have recorded using studying coincidence detection, and ask the question, can we change the coupling, the synaptic strength of this synapses by activating these neurons in a coincident burst type activity. The next slide shows the measuring parameter. The experimental situation, as I just explained, is such that we generate an action potential in the presynaptic neuron, and we are measuring on the postsynaptic side an excitatory postsynaptic potential. And as a measure of synaptic strength, we use the amplitude of the EPSP. An increase in the amplitude would indicate that the synaptic strength is increased, whereas a decrease in the EPSP would indicate that the coupling between these two neurons is decreased. You would call this either potentiation or long-term potentiation or long-term depression. Now, the next slide shows what is happening if we study a pair of neurons using this dual recording technique. What you see here are presynaptic action potentials, as I just explained in the previous slide, causing postsynaptic EPSPs. And we combine these postsynaptic EPSPs with action potentials in the postsynaptic neuron. Now, we do this under a variety of patterns. The one that gave the strongest result is if one combines two or three action potentials occurring coincidentally in the pre- and the postsynaptic side, on the postsynaptic neuron, almost at the same time. If it is such that the postsynaptic action potential just follows the EPSP by an interval of about 10 milliseconds, one sees a very strong increase in synaptic coupling as indicated by the increase in the size of the EPSP. This is before pairing, this is after pairing, and following such coincident activity repeated 20 or 50 times, there is a very strong increase in this coupling. This is shown for about 20 neurons in this part of the graph. This is a control situation, our baseline. If we pair activity in the pre- and the postsynaptic neuron such that they occur almost coincident, there is on average an increase by about 30 to 35% in the synaptic coupling. Now, the next slide shows that not only we can increase the synaptic coupling between neurons, but we also can decrease it. And this depends critically on the time interval of activity in the pre- and the postsynaptic side. What you see here is coincident activity in the pre- and the postsynaptic neuron such that the postsynaptic action potential occur between 10 and 100 milliseconds after the EPSP, and there is a stable increase. If it is longer than 100 milliseconds, nothing is happening. This is this line. If, on the other hand, the postsynaptic action potential precedes the EPSP, there is a depression in synaptic connection, in synaptic strength. So apparently, when such burst activity in two neurons that are synaptically coupled is occurring repeatedly, depending on the time interval between the pre- and the postsynaptic neuron, one gets either an increase or a decrease in synaptic coupling. This could, again, this is a speculation, be part of the mechanism that underlies the lowering of threshold if an animal, let's say a mouse or a rat, is exposed to coincident stimuli to two different modalities. The last part of the talk I would like to spend on the possible mechanism that underlies this change in synaptic strength. Could I have the next slide, please? These synapses, which you saw in one of the previous slides, are so-called axospinous synapses. That is, the presynaptic terminal forms a synapse with a postsynaptic specialization, which is called the spine. And the current that is generating the EPSP is flowing through so-called glutamate receptors because the transmitter is glutamate, acting on glutamate receptor. And when these glutamate receptors are opening, the EPSP is generated. Now, what we have observed is an increase or a decrease in the size of these glutamate receptor-mediated currents, and therefore we studied what might be the change in the glutamate receptors, or what might be an initial change that could cause an increase or decrease in the response of these glutamate receptors to presynaptically released glutamate. Now, we found that when the calcium that is increased following stimulation by backpropagating action potential or by an EPSP is blocked by dialyzing the postsynaptic neuron with BAPTA or with EGTA, these changes in synaptic strength are no longer occurring, indicating that probably the first step that leads to a change in synaptic strength is triggered by an increase in calcium in these small structures. Now, over the past 5 years, a new technique, experimental tool, has been developed by Winfried Denk and Ward Webb, which is referred to as the two-photon microscopy. It allows one to look at the changes in calcium concentration using a calcium indicator with a very high time resolution, and we use this technique to identify or find out what are the changes in calcium in these spines under the two different protocols, which either lead to an increase or to a decrease in synaptic strength. The next slide shows the experimental setup. This is a layer two neuron in this case. This is a blow-up on the right side. You can see the dendrite, the parent dendrite, and these are individual spines. This neuron has been filled with a fluorescent indicator, in this case, Oregon green. And we are scanning along this line with this two-photon excitation instrument, looking at the change in calcium in a single spine when an action potential, a backpropagating action potential, invades the dendritic tree and when an EPSP is generated. And in the lower part of the slide, you see that both signals, a backpropagating action potential and an EPSP, generate a sharply rising calcium transient, which is, in this particular experiment, about of the same size. Now, what happens if we combine the action potential and the EPSP in such a way that either the action potential precedes or follows the EPSP? Remember, these are the two situations where we get either an increase or a decrease in synaptic strength, and the result is shown on the next slide. Next slide, please. These are the two experimental situations. An action potential is followed by an EPSP, or an action potential follows the EPSP. These are the two signals measured in a single spine, and the summary of this is shown here by plotting the change in calcium for the two sequences, action potential followed by an EPSP or action potential preceding an EPSP. And you can clearly see that for all experiments, the calcium transient is larger for the situation where the EPSP where the action potential follows the EPSP, that is the situation where we get a strengthening of synaptic connections. The next slide shows a so-called tuning curve. What we have done here is combine or look at the time dependence of the summation of these calcium signals for various intervals between the dendritic action potential and the EPSP. That is, action potential precedes the EPSP, it's coincident or it follows the EPSP, and the result is shown here. This would correspond to linear summation. If the action potential precedes the EPSP, there is sublinear summation. If they are coincident, within about 100 milliseconds, there is potentiation. If they are separated by more than 100 to 150 milliseconds, there is no interaction. Indicating that, or at least that's another hypothesis, that it might indicate that it is the difference in the time and space signal when there is supralinear summation of the EPSP and the action potential initiated calcium transient. Preliminary evidence indicates that these are not the two coins of the same metal. These are completely different mechanisms, and probably in normal operation of these neurons, there's always a mixture, an overlay of depression and synaptic depression and synaptic potentiation, and it depends on the exact time pattern of pre- and postsynaptic neuron within this time window of about 100 milliseconds, whether there will be potentiation or whether there will be depression. This brings me to the end. The last slide just summarizes what I've been trying to say. I showed you that layer 5 pyramidal neurons have a mechanism that allows them to transmit action potentials into the dendritic tree. These backpropagating action potentials are part of a mechanism that allows neurons to detect coincident input into layer 1 and to layer 5. This occurs within a time window in the order of about 10 to 15 milliseconds. This coincidence detection mechanism is very sensitive to inhibition from the local interneurons. A speculation of what this might mean to the brain is that it could be a mechanism that allows the cortex to associate stimuli from different modalities. I've also shown you that such coincident burst activity, which is generated by this association mechanism when occurring in neighboring neuron, is a trigger for a change in synaptic strength. And the initial step in changing this synaptic strength is a difference in the calcium inflow into individual synaptic spines. And the last slide then shows my collaborators. Next slide, please. All this work has been done with the help of postdocs. If you could focus this, please, that are listed here. Okay, well, I just, can you focus, please? Down. Well, I'll just tell you, it was Matthew Larkham, Greg Stewart, Jackie Schiller, Henry Markram, and recently Helmut Köster and Nai Brunaschew. Thank you very much for your attention.